Hey listeners, if you love the show and you want to support This Anthro Life, you can go to anchor.fm and support us by either giving a dollar, $5, or $10. They make it extremely simple and really easy to do, and we appreciate everything that you can offer to help us make this content great.
And now, on to the show. Good afternoon, listeners. This is Adam Gable here for This Anthropological Life here on March 25th, 1 p.m. And again, I'm Adam Gable.
And this is Anil Tripathi.
We're joined today in studio by a very special guest, Emily Canning. She's working on her PhD here at Brandeis. She does work in Central Asia. And as we said last week, this episode is going to be sort of a special edition on Crimea, on the issues going on in Central Asia. And we want to sort of turn our anthropological lens to looking at issues of nationalism, of ethnicity, of language, of media, and different ways that these ideas that we see in anthropology come together around this international event. I just want to say hello, welcome to the program, Emily.
Hi, thank you. This is Emily Canning, and as Adam mentioned, I'm a graduate student here, and I conduct my research in southern Kyrgyzstan on issues with language and how they relate to ethnic identity. And a lot of the issues I've seen in Kyrgyzstan are happening in parallel with the situation in Crimea. And in fact, I was able to visit Crimea last year when I was living in Kyrgyzstan, even though they're quite far from one another. But because they were both part of the former Soviet Union, they share a lot of issues regarding these questions of language and ethnic identity.
And so I guess kind of kick it off, we can think about some of the, maybe you can kind of help us put together the picture of what's been happening. And so where we are today, we think Crimea was just recently annexed, right? And so there's this controversy over whether, you know, Russia will be kicked out of the G8 or not, which is the international summit of, quote, developed countries, right? Mm-hmm. And there's different issues of ethnicity of, like, do the Tatars, these, which is the Russian ethnic speaking group, correct? Are they?
Well, Crimea is quite an interesting place because it was part of the Russian Empire for a few centuries, but before that, it was part of Khanate, which of Turkic-speaking groups called Crimean Tatars today. And they still live in the peninsula today, but they're actually a minority now, only 14% of the population. And that's because during the 1940s, they were forcibly deported by Stalin to basically Central Asia, where I end up working. And now they're only sort of beginning to come back, but finding Russians sort of had occupied their previous land. And because of that, they are sort of the least enthusiastic supporters of this annexation by Russia. But since, as a result of their deportation, it was ethnic Russians who moved in to take their place, they now comprise a majority of Crimea's population, and therefore they sort of are welcoming Putin with open arms as far as their population is concerned. But the other groups, Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, are less than thrilled about the recent acquisition.
Yeah, all of the the ethnic groups in Crimea, it almost brings to light something that's so important, I feel, in this issue, in that, you know, this area has just so much history behind it, right? And so much history of tensions.
Definitely.
And it's almost kind of been a ground of contestation for you know, hundreds of years. If we think back to the Crimean War, it was, you know, a major focal point between the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire.
Right.
And so throughout this history, all of these different groups have been interacting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I found that's been interesting with this event coming up in the recent weeks is how there have been so many articles, right, hearkening, saying that this is a harken back to old politics, right, that this is almost going back to an era that, you know, we supposedly left. But then, of course, this is so much of a continuation as well, right?
Right. Although I think the danger in talking about history in that respect is sort of projecting our ideas of the present onto the past, because it's true that it's always been a politically contested territory precisely due to its strategic location, like in the Black Sea and near the Mediterranean by default. But we have to think about these new issues regarding ethnicity and language are actually quite recent, because it wasn't really until the Soviet Union came into being and started reifying or making real these ethno-national groups that compromised basically states at the time but have now become independent countries, that these problems started taking place. Because otherwise, during Soviet times, they were considered sort of unified into, you know, having the same status and citizenship. But nowadays, in the former Soviet countries, the ethnicity that's sort of called the titular ethnicity, or the one who's country sort of came into being, they're the ones who have privileged rights and in the country. So that's, I think, the newness. And but yes, it's always been politically contested, for sure.
And it's very interesting, right? With that reification, so many linguistic issues come into play, mm-hmm. right? I think this relates very well to your work, Emily.
Definitely. In fact, I think language is a really interesting problem in Ukrainian politics, because for so long and during Soviet times across the Soviet Union, Russian was sort of considered the language of prestige. In fact, Russians always say it's the great and powerful Russian language. Like, they have an idea that their language is capable of, you know, a rich literature and all these other things. But they actually considered Ukrainian to be sort of this inferior peasant corruption of Russian, and what that actually wasn't its own legitimate language. And so Ukrainians felt like highly defensive when they were able to finally have their own nation state. They worked really hard to promote Ukrainian. But like, I found Russians, for instance, in Central Asia that like live in Uzbekistan or in Kyrgyzstan that say, why would I learn Uzbek or Kyrgyz? Like, when Russian is obviously like a better, like these languages are inferior, essentially. Huh. So Russians very much have that attitude about their language, at least in former Soviet countries in which I've experienced. Hmm.
It's something, I mean, it's interesting, it's comparable here in the United States, right? We may think of when you travel abroad as a U.S. citizen, you may think of saying, well, why don't you speak English? Or, you know, which may seem ironic to us, right?
Right.
But there is this notion that sort of the language of the bigger countries, that we call them, that have a larger global influence, would think about that they should have sort of this dominant discourse, right? That you should speak English.
Definitely. And actually, it's very much to do with the variety of the language itself you speak itself also is important. For instance, like Southern English is often stereotyped as, you know, the people who speak it, you know, therefore must not be as smart because they're speaking at a slower pace or whatever. Things like that happen with Ukrainians as well. Like, whenever you watch a TV show in Russia and you want to show a character that's not very bright, they'll have that character speak with a Ukrainian accent or use Ukrainian words.
That's interesting.
So, yeah, these stereotypes continue.
Mm. I mean, do you find, so in thinking about media, this is a great way to think about it. So we're talking just in, like, television programs, right? Maybe soap operas or comedy shows or something, right? Mm-hmm. That these dialogues or dialects, we should say, right, or these languages are used intentionally to point out hierarchies of either knowledge, right, which index something beyond the language that's being spoken, right?
Right.
Something to do with the mental capacity or mm-hmm. whatever.
Precisely.
It's a really interesting thing to think about, this sort of language ideology and language hierarchy, right? What is there sort of a notion of a better language or worse language, right?
Right. And even inherent in the way you talk about Ukraine, it's very much embedded in language ideology. There's a special preposition in Russian, whether or not you use the preposition na versus v to indicate something is inside of something else implies whether that entity is its own independent entity or merely a borderland or sub-entity of the larger group. And so Russians often refer to Ukraine as na Ukraino, and Ukrainians will use v, because they're trying to assert the fact that, so they would say na Alaska, because it's like Alaska is part of the United States, right?
Ah, interesting.
So Russians will continue to use na for Ukraine, because in fact the word krai is border and u means away from. So Ukraina is basically like the borderland. That's how Russians have perceived it, and like even the etymology of Ukraine like sort of shows that historical perspective.
So definitely with this issue also, Russia now is in a position that where it needs to justify so much of its actions, right? Especially to the larger world. So have you seen kind of these changes in linguistics within the language of the Russian politicians themselves, such as Putin?
Oh, yes. Well, actually, today there was, in fact, a radio story about an interesting change in Putin's language. He, in the past, have always used one term to refer to Russian citizens and now uses a different one, and I'll explain the difference. So the two ways to refer to someone from Russia are rossiyski or ruski. And rossiyski would mean someone of the Russian Federation, but it's neutral as far as ethnic connotations are concerned. But the word ruski implies that you are like ethnically Russian. So if you were, for instance, a Russian Jew or a Crimean Tatar, you couldn't be ruski. You would have to be rossiyski. So the fact that Putin, for the first time as he addressed the public, used the word ruski was to connotate Russian ethnicity was very telling, and I think reflects this sort of uprising and nationalist sentiments following, you know, the annexation of Crimea.
It's such an interesting juncture to see this change in language, because again, it's a specific idea to grab onto, this notion of an ethnic collection, right? That's beyond what may be seen as nationalism, which is not necessarily an ethnic identity, right? It's sort of a, as we've said before on the show, like Benedict Anderson's imagined communities, right? This idea that we're connected by something bigger than ourselves, but not necessarily something that's genetic, right? It's an affiliation, whether by reading newspapers or something, right? And it raises some really interesting questions of like how we can see sort of state ideas and state ideologies in practice right now, right? Because we're seeing this notion of this sort of Russian grab for this Crimean space, and then trying to say, are we going to make this part of a nation, right? Or is it an ethnic thing or what? And how do we sort of overcome what might seem to be an artificial boundary?
Well, right. And the problem is, too, that, you know, these imagined communities, as you mentioned, are quite recent in reality, actually, because, you know, the Soviet Union only came apart in 1991. So as a result, they've had a lot of work to sort of forge that national identity in the meantime, whereas other countries have had much longer. So I think that is also an issue, is sort of that Ukraine hadn't had a chance to really bring in its diverse parts, because the western part is highly Ukrainian as far as their ethnic and national identity is concerned, but the eastern part identifies more closely with Russia. So they sort of hadn't had a chance to like bring it all together into an identity that's not linked purely with ethnicity, because that was the problem, is that's what they were going for, but then they ended up alienating a large part of their population as a result.
And that's one of the big challenges. I guess that's sort of the hope with this dialogue that Putin is using, and changing the way that we talk about sort of an ethnic collection, right, versus something else.
Yeah, but it ends up alienating a huge part of the Russian population, because, I mean, Russia is enormous. There's tons of different ethnic groups, at least dozens of different ones, all the way from, like, near the Mongolian border and, you know, Siberia to, like, you know, Crimean Tatars and Tatars in Tatarstan as well. So, like, it seems like a dangerous move on his end, because he could end up promoting the same or provoking the same problem that Ukraine is having within Russia itself. If he begins to, for instance, the Central Asians who work there as basically temporary workers often are like beaten or like deported forcibly, like without explanation, as a result of, you know, growing racism and xenophobia within Russia itself. So I think that's a danger.
Do you think also with changes within Russia itself between ethnic groups, that this could also affect amongst ethnic Russians outside of Russia, in the neighboring countries especially?
Definitely. I think that that is the case, although I've noticed that in ethnic violence in Kyrgyzstan, where I've worked, it actually hasn't been typically targeting Russians, who are about 10% of the population, whereas Meshedi and Turks and Uzbeks were both attacked but largely by Kyrgyz and their homes destroyed. And I think part of that reason is because they are afraid of the state of Russia as well, because Russia has a huge influence politically and in the media as well, like throughout the former Soviet Union. So I think that this was also the case in parts of Ukraine as well.
I wonder, I mean, do we see specific flows of media, too, in terms of what's being displayed about what is happening in Crimea, in terms of whether there's protests for or against this annexation? And particularly, you know, it's harder for us to see. I mean, we may have Russian television, you know, Russian Times. We can watch the news here. The U.S. version, English version for us, we don't speak Russian. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, it's pretty hard to get what might be, you know, these different media channels that may, whether it be in Russia or in Crimea or something. I mean, have you had any experience for seeing certain kinds of specific medias that are happening are being displayed over there?
I think Russians are ambivalent, but I think more of them would be likely to support the move, because actually it wasn't until 1957 that Crimea was officially given to the Ukraine. And that was sort of a symbolic act in the sense that it was part of the Soviet Union. So at that time it was completely irrelevant as to whether or not, you know, It's like if a county of New Hampshire gets allocated to Massachusetts, no one's going to, like, you know, be really, really upset. But in this case, that's what was happening. So now, so they sort of were like, well, that was a nice thing of us to do then, but, you know, it was really ours all along. So what are you thinking?
It's interesting. I mean, it does raise questions in terms of these, like, smaller provinces versus larger nations in this case, right? And that these, obviously, the chips can change, the dominoes can fall in this case, right? And it depends on who gets what from what pot.
Right, exactly.
But of course, the idea, as we're saying, is that there's a whole incredible mix of diversity just within this one region.
Definitely.
Right? And so there's, of course, going to be, even geographically, the Western versus Eastern sort of notions of what side people may fall on, you know, whether they're pro or sort of against annexation in this case.
Right. That's it. The same problem happened in Kyrgyzstan, where I do my research, because the city I worked in, Osh, it's actually a majority Uzbek ethnic population and has been for as long as there's been an idea of Uzbeks as a discrete ethnic identity. But as a result of the Soviet Union falling, all of a sudden Uzbeks are seen as sort of alien in their own land, aliens in their own land, because Osh happens to be located on the border with Uzbekistan. So they say, actually, no, you guys belong to Uzbekistan. So the same things are happening in other parts of the Soviet Union with borders, like as we also saw in Georgia, with Abkhazia and things, places like that. Basically, different groups were unsettled, because at the time in which these borders were drawn in the 1920s, they weren't thinking about it in terms of it being its own, you know, national entity at the time. So now, all of a sudden, these are creating huge problems because people weren't very careful. In fact, Stalin himself was largely responsible for a lot of these borders, because he was in charge of the Commission for the Nationalities at the time in which these were. Yeah, so. Like, in Central Asia, it's insane, because there's, like, pieces of Uzbekistan in Kyrgyzstan and pieces of Tajikistan in Kyrgyzstan, and, like, they're completely surrounded by the other country. So it's almost like someone just, like, spilled coffee on a map and arbitrarily drew some lines.
Yeah,
so nowadays that people are trying to sort of yoke nationality with ethnicity, it's causing problems, because at the time in which these borders were drawn, it wasn't clear, like, there would be Kyrgyz and Uzbek villages next to each other, you know, mixed all over the place. You couldn't say, like, this area is Kyrgyz, this area is Uzbek. And so I think the same thing is happening to some extent in Ukraine as well.
It's interesting. I mean, I can think of, you know, common examples of the same thing in South America, too. And they would divvy up when the borders happened. They would just literally cut in half of where two tribes lived. And they now live across borders. And there's wonderful examples, actually, in Mexico and Guatemala border, where Rebecca Galemba talks about these different groups that have been ethnically the same for thousands of years, but they've been split up by this border. They still cross and do these interesting illicit sort of trading practices, but to them it's just been that's business as usual, right? Mm. When you come in and impose a different kind of border, of course the question is, like, the illicit becomes illicit just like that. Mm. Or then, you know, or sort of cleavages are just formed just like that. It's really an interesting and tricky split, I think, but we're thinking about. I think as well, a thing that you and I were talking about, Emily, a little before the show, was the notion that this part of the world sometimes seems to be in a geographic black hole to a lot of people in the West, right? Mm-hmm. This region is not really on a lot of our mental maps.
Right.
And what's up with that?
Well, the first is probably that Americans are not the most well-versed in geography. I remember in Kyrgyzstan, people would be shocked to hear that I didn't have a separate geography class in school when I was growing up, because they always, in fact, do. So that's, I think, the first problem. But the second problem is, again, since these borders are relatively recent in our history, although 91 is still, you know,
within our lifetime, so, you know,
But so, you know, at that time, the Soviet Union is enormous, and it broke into, you know, like, at least I believe 20 different entities. So, I think because of its size is one, but again, I think it's more an issue of not knowing geography. But people I've talked to, when I say I work in Kyrgyzstan, are often like, oh, so that's like in Eastern Europe, or like, and I'm like, actually, no, it borders China, you know. So people. But in fact, there are many connections to Boston. Want to talk?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so as I had mentioned, in the 1940s, Stalin had forcibly deported the Crimean Tatars to Central Asia. And in fact, a little known fact that people were able to remember is that the Tsarnaev brothers, who committed the Boston bombings, were actually, in fact, born in Kyrgyzstan, and they weren't born in Chechnya, precisely because, like these Crimean Tatars, they were their family was basically forcibly uprooted from Chechnya and placed in Kyrgyzstan thousands of miles away. Mm. So it's like, this is a form of violence as well that happened in the 40s and continues to have ramifications for today, as we can see, and even in our own daily lives.
Right. So here to give another voice to the conversation is Ryan Collins.
Oh, thanks, Sunil. So, Emily, I'm really curious about the time depth that we're talking about here, because we're talking about this mixing up of boundaries, this sort of spilt coffee, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are these issues of borders, of territory, compounded not only by the fallout of revolutions in the early 20th century, World War II, and the fall of the Soviet Union, Would you say that that's an accurate statement?
So are you asking if, like, there were borders before that that were sort of relevance?
Well, that maybe the spilt milk, is it just getting worse?
Oh, right. I see what you mean. Yes, that's definitely the case, in that it wasn't sort of carved up into so many discrete chunks in the past before that. I believe it was part of sort of the Turkic sphere of influence for several centuries.
Right.
And before that, there was, like, Greek influence as well. So Crimea has sort of gone through many different hands and has been contested. But as I mentioned before you got here, what's sort of new is this idea that there is a specific ethno-national group that should belong to a specific territory with a specific language. And I think that that's being imprinted on a region that actually has been historically diverse in character.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, with this history, there have just been so many different treaties that have been signed over, you know, hundreds of years regarding this land.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually something I went around on the internet talking about how now that Crimea declared independence, it should actually go to Turkey, right? Because they have a claim from the Ottoman Empire going back.
Right, and
a
Crimean Tatars, whose language highly resembles Turkish, would actually be way more thrilled about that.
Yeah.
And in fact, the Crimean Tatars I stayed with while I was there were actually had professional ties to Turkey and had sort of gone there to work, because for them it's quite easy. Like, they're able to pick up the language in a matter of weeks and things like that. So that group would be happy. But of course, we know that Russia would not be so thrilled like that, and it might start another Crimean war.
This is, again, this is very interesting to me that these territories are seeming to be cut in relation to what are presumed to be cultural boundaries.
But see, that's presumed, but it in fact is much messier than even Russia is making it out to be, as far as if you look at a map, the places where Russian speakers are versus Ukrainian speakers are, there is sort of like a gradation as you move away from the Russian border and move towards Poland, that it becomes more and more Ukrainian. But what happened when sort of national boundaries became drawn in this part of the world is that, you know, they were trying to make groups that didn't actually exist, even with regard to language. Like, these form like a dialect continuum, basically. Like, towards the Polish border, you'll have Slavic languages that resemble Polish more, and then you'll have parts where that it's a mixture of Russian and Ukrainian. In fact, there's a word for this in Kiev, in the capital, called Surzhik, and people look often condescendingly with this language variety, but there's also those who sort of praise it as like their natural like language of birth or from childhood. So yeah, it's people are trying to cut it up, but it's the boundaries themselves are not quite as neat as they're trying to make it out to be.
Right, and this really pairs a lot of discussions in the 90s with anthropology about the landscape, about ethnoscapes, and that people really aren't bounded to these fixed entities of land, you know? I'm just thinking about, like, Ferguson and Gupta had a nice article about that, and that seems to be the prevalent thought today, but this sort of step towards trying to group people in, knowing that that can't really be done, seems sort of backwards.
Definitely, and that's sort of the paradox of nationalism, at least in this part of the world, in trying to create a national identity that has sort of an ethnic exclusion woven into it, whereas in the United States, at least our like formal national ideology is sort of to include all groups as, you know, equal American citizens. Of course, in practice, this doesn't always happen, but nevertheless, that is the official ideology. But unfortunately, this is not the case in many parts of the Soviet Union, where, like, I was told by in Kyrgyzstan, like, that Uzbeks should just simply go back to Uzbekistan, when in fact they'd lived on that land for centuries.
Right.
In their family homes.
I mean, I find this particularly haunting, scary. This is has a lot of parallels to terrible movements in the 20th century.
Definitely, and in fact, there could be some kind of ethnic violence, especially against Crimean Tatars. I was sort of reminded of when I was in Osh during ethnic violence there that lasted 4 days and killed like several hundred people in June of 2010. Mm-hmm. There was actually people marking X's on the doors of Uzbek homes, and actually I heard recently that in Crimean Tatar homes that Russians were doing the same, as marking their homes with an X to show who would not be loyal, essentially, to the Russian state.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's a lot of parallels with this.
Definitely.
This is interesting also, right, because one of Putin's motivations supposedly for going into Crimea, right, is that he wants to protect Russians from supposed violence.
Right.
Do you think there's any justification for that?
Not especially, because they, in fact, are the majority of the population. And so he's treating them as a vulnerable minority because he's comparing them to the Ukrainian population as a whole. But in fact, they're a privileged minority that sees themselves as entitled and, you know, yoked to a superior language and culture, essentially. So I don't think that there's any justification for that, especially not in Crimea, because really Crimean Tatars are the vulnerable minority, being at only 14% of the populations, whereas Russian comprise the majority.
And is this a similar case for other Russian minorities in countries such as, you know, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan?
I think Russians and other minorities in other former Soviet countries feel threatened because they are upset with ethno-nationalism that has taken root in those places after the fall of the Soviet Union. For instance, Russians in Kyrgyzstan are not pleased about having to learn Kyrgyz, and they still continue to not, like, even a Russian friend of mine in Osh, where I was staying, there Russians are only 5% of the population, and she didn't know Kyrgyz, which is amazing.
Wow,
like,
yeah,
that you can grow up in a place and not learn the national language, essentially. So I don't think they're really quite as vulnerable as they make themselves out to be, though a lot of them are leaving the former Soviet countries and returning to Russia. But then a lot of times they go to Russia and realize it's not quite so great there as they had imagined, and they end up returning, for instance, to Central Asia or the Baltics, because, well, the weather's nicer, people are more hospitable, they actually realize that it wasn't so bad after all. They ended up there for a reason.
Do you think, is there actually ever any prejudice from Russians against Russians from these fears?
Yes, actually, a lot of Russians I spoke to who had gone to Russia were surprised that they were treated like Central Asians or like wherever they had come from the periphery, and they were not expecting such a reception.
They're almost caught in a liminal space, right, where their identity works one way in one place, but then
and they feel like they can't win because, like, in Kyrgyzstan they're not going to be accepted as, you know, full citizens, and that, you know, in order to even be president you have to pass a Kyrgyz language exam, and to be in the parliament you have to, you know, have some competency in Kyrgyz. So they feel like this is not simply a possibility for them, it's not their country anymore, unlike during Soviet times when they had a special privilege, like being native speakers of the language that was commonly used in politics and daily life.
So there is a lot of this sort of parallel isolation happening on the larger political scale too, because we're seeing this happening on the localized area there, but we're also seeing Russia's isolation with the West potentially being kicked out of the G8 summit as of yesterday.
Yes, that is true, but I'm sort of skeptical as far as the long-term ramifications of such things are concerned, because I think Russia has enough strength economically, at least with Europe and with parts of the former Soviet Union, that they can continue to operate freely as they wish within that sphere. It's true that there might be some diplomatic sanctions or other economic sanctions as a result, but I honestly would be skeptical if it affected Russia in any significant way, because we also depend on them to some extent.
Yeah, that's one of the things that struck me. I was reading about some of the sanctions that were happening, right? And of course, they're talking about, you know, economic sanctions or whatever. But one of the things that really struck me in a piece I was reading that was talking about the sanctions have consequences for the people that are sanctioning, right? This is not just a punishment that's doled out, but again, as you said, Emily, like there's a connection back and forth here, right? And that, you know, Paris sells arms to Russia, and if there's a sanction against them economically, they literally can't sell them. And then Britain sort of depends on they do some sort of financial trading with oligarchs. I don't know if they talk about this very much, but they do. And so either one of these, if they're doing kind of sanctions from the EU, like they're a little more backed off than the US is. You know, the US gets other resources from Russia, so it's
right.
Like,
because we're farther away, we sort of have the luxury of doing that, whereas, yeah, the EU has been sort of more muted because Russia has a lot of oil and Europe depends on that, so it's not going to be happening in a significant way.
Or as you said, maybe not in a long-term way either, right? Because even the thing is, the U.S., though, you know, the U.S. does tend to push certain sanctions, and it is, in some ways, because we are isolated in this way from a lot of geographically, I mean, you know, we're mm-hmm. not isolated economically mm-hmm. at all. But
definitely.
I think it plays in the mentality that, you know, the U.S. is over here, and therefore it can sort of talk outwards from its tower.
Right. You know? But I mean, and we'll always sort of do the dance of, oh, we care about human rights, yada, yada. But, mm, like, right. you know, only to a point. Like, we won't talk about it if it starts to affect our economic interests.
Right, very much. I mean, I think that's very apparent in the different sides of views that are coming out of the immediate reactions to Russia being kicked out of the G8. And Russia doesn't seem to be too affected by this. They don't seem to take it as a threat where the U.S. is pushing it as a threat.
Right, yeah, yeah. Right. Putin just said if it ran its course, that's fine. You know, yeah. if it's over, fine, whatever, you know.
Yeah, I don't think he cares too much about what other people
right.
think about him.
I think if you're a president, you can't, you know, or how you run things.
Well, but in the U.S., I think it's a different political, like,
yeah.
like you
yes.
know, there's always opinion polls and things like that, and people are always trying to cater to public opinion and craft their responses to questions in such a way that will get them the most votes.
Mm.
But Putin sort of does his own thing.
Yeah. And his identity almost seems to be completely secure, right? I mean, nowadays, mm. even in the U.S., right, we refer to Russia as Putin's Russia.
Mm-hmm.
You hear that over and over again in the news.
Yeah,
definitely. I don't think he's going to be going anywhere anytime soon. And in fact, throughout the former Soviet Union, you see that the people who were in power at the fall of the Soviet Union have largely managed to stay in power. And a lot of the republics, like particularly where I've worked in Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, there's been several revolutions. But Belarus, for instance, it remains a dictatorship since... Mm-hmm. The fall. So yeah, that pattern repeats itself throughout of a lot of these countries.
And even thinking about, you know, the economic ties within Europe, I think there was an article that came out in The Guardian a while back, actually going through the steps a Russian oligarch could take to become an accepted member of British society. So, you know, you have to send your kids to the right prep school, give such and such amount of money to these organizations,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, set up an institution in your name,
mm-hmm.
and you can be accepted. But I mean, what's interesting with these sanctions, I think that it does seem that the European politicians really want to, you know, be as harsh sounding as they can right now.
Right.
But then, I mean, there really is this thought. I mean, how far can they really go? I mean, you even have Angela Merkel being very vocal right now.
Right.
But of course, Germany's, you know, heavily economically tied to Russia.
Right. And yeah, I suspect it's mostly all bark and no bite. And mm-hmm. even as far as the Russian diaspora is concerned, there's a large group in Germany, here in the U.S., in England, as you suggested. And so these ties exist throughout and are unlikely to be broken as a result of the situation in Ukraine. There's not a whole lot anyone can do, it seems, at this point.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough interconnection here that it seems that... It's funny, because Anna Singh talks about that there's, like, the global and the local scapes thinking about
right.
it. And that the global is this, in essence, she calls it a fiction in some ways, right? That it exists, but it's sort of this meta-discourse that we're talking about, because there are these sort of either everyday practices of becoming a citizen, or
mm-hmm.
whether you can become a British citizen if you want to, as a Russian oligarch, or the other idea of there's economic, there's financial, whatever kinds of ties across these national borders anyway that essentially blur them,
mm-hmm.
right? These exist as, you know, there's a physical border that is Britain or Paris or whatever, London, but France. But when it comes down to it, right, these ties just crisscross these anyway. And, like, so these sanctions, in some ways, it's really interesting to think about them as what are they trying to do, right? Because they're saying, we're going to punish you financially for now.
I think it's almost like symbolic.
Yeah, it's symbolic
way.
Punishment,
it's,
right?
Yeah,
and
it's like
what does
a
that
wrist
mean?
Slap. It's not a sock in the face. Like, it's not going to affect, like, real
yeah.
change of any sort, I don't think.
And when you say that, it's like, I think about the idea of symbols, right? It's like, it's Bourdieu's symbolic capital, or, you know, it's like,
mm-hmm.
they're not losing any symbolic capital here. I mean, they might be losing some sort of street cred with the West, but when it comes down to it, they have a very different kind of symbolic capital, right? That's what Putin's saying. I don't care if you kick me out of the G8 or us,
right?
It's a very
right.
different kind of thing he's operating with.
Well, yeah, and to what effect will these sanctions actually be meaningful is another perspective if you compare it to what he's gaining from annexing
mm.
Crimea,
mm.
because Crimea itself is rich with natural resources, and
yeah.
I'm sure he's going to be gaining a lot from the acquisition. So it's sort of a drop in the bucket to even suggest sanctions.
Right, it's true. I mean, even actually, because Anil, you mentioned how this is sort of talked about as Putin's Russia. One of the banks that was targeted for sanctions was it's called Russia Bank or something. I can't say it, but it's the 19th largest bank, which is not the biggest in Russia, but it has direct ties to Putin. So they only sanctioned that one. You know, so you can see it's like this direct, like, this is the bank we're going to punish because this one's tied to Putin.
Interesting.
A very interesting, you know, like, direct choice that you can very least, you can see what they're trying to do here, you know. Mm. Not publishing, they're punishing the People's Bank. If there's,
and yet, I don't think Putin will suffer too tremendously.
Something tells me no.
Yeah.
Right. And he's gaining tremendously almost in Russia even, right? Popular support for taking Crimea is, you know, fairly high.
Right, just like in the U.S., like, nationalism tends to go up as soon as we go into defense mode, because it's like, that's when you have to, you know, rally around the president without, you know, sort of unthinkingly almost. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that's happening in parallel.
Exactly. I mean, when countries go into defense mode, it's almost like this weird extended symbolic kinship, right? Everybody gets around the idea of their core national identity and creates this other in a new way.
Right, and it's the other that sort of is used to define what is. So
exactly.
I think having that common enemy is definitely a rallying point as well.
Ends up being necessary, I think. Because, again, as we're talking about here, we're looking at, like, these borders are shifting, identities are shifting, and, like, in singular places like Crimea have so much ethnic, cultural, linguistic diversity anyway. Right? We need sort of, like, right, this solidification that, not that this happened because of this, but, you know, that this solidification that comes from sort of being in a state of emergency or a state of change. Right? Naomi Klein talks about the shock doctrine, right? A disaster capitalism, right? That we have to have these uproarious moments in which then we can now then say, oh, there's the other. It's much clearer now. You know, when in fact the other, if there is such a thing, is all around us anyway, right? We are constantly making self and other sort of thoughts, you know, based on what we're doing at the time. You know, media tells us different things or whatever, but it is interesting, these sort of uproarious moments that may punctuate or make us sort of either creation of this new kind of other, what purpose that has, as I think we're kind of pointing towards, or what, you know, is this just a straw man kind of thing that we can then say, oh, yeah, right, that was just there because we were having a freak out moment, you know, or annexing this place right now or something, but you know, I wonder.
Yeah, and people say a lot of the same stuff about North Korea, right? Whenever they stir anything up, people say, especially when Kim Jong-un first came to power, you know, people were, a lot of analysts were thinking the reason why he's doing so many aggressive actions is so that he sees where everybody stands, you know, both outside but also inside, you know, who is really loyal to him in North Korea. And we could even, you know, possibly think about this within Russia, you know, who's loyal to Putin.
Yeah, in fact, I can even tell a joke about that if you would like to hear it.
Oh, of course.
Okay, so Putin and Obama, they're actually together at a conference in Niagara Falls. And Putin wants to prove to Obama that his citizens are more loyal to him than Obama's. So Putin asks Obama to prove his citizens are loyal by volunteering to jump off Niagara Falls to prove their loyalty. So Obama goes up to someone who's passing by, who's an American, and he says, "Sir, do you love your country?" And the man's like, "Yes." And he's like, "Well, would you jump off Niagara Falls for me?" And he's like, "I'm sorry, you know, I do love my country, but I have a wife and kids, so I'm sorry." So he's like, "Okay." So Putin goes up to a guy, sees a Russian, he's like, "Jump off the falls." Without hesitation, the guy takes a running swan dive off, and miraculously, he manages to survive the fall. So Obama goes to visit him in the hospital, and he's like, "Well, what is it? Why did you do that? Why did you do this for Russia, for Putin?" He says, like, "Well, you see, it's because I have a wife and kids."
Oh, yeah. It's all your motivation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, it's different perceptions of, you know, the state and sort of its presence in your daily life, basically.
And the reach of it, right? Mm-hmm. And what it's able to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's also thinking about this politically. It's interesting to see, you know, we're almost at a stage, especially if we think about states kind of facing their other, where, you know, these larger countries, you know, Russia, U.S. as well. There's just almost been so much, you know, hypocrisy in our state policies and our international policy that people can almost justify any argument. I mean, especially with Syria and everything, right? Russia was such a pro, you know, sovereignty, state sovereignty, the idea that we couldn't go in and, you know, upset a state, you know, just exactly the way Russia did with Ukraine. So, you know, this is a huge turnaround. But then, of course, Russia can always say, you know, look at what the U.S. has done in Central America and South America. And there are just so many examples to choose from.
Yeah, even more recently on the Colbert Report, when he was discussing this, he was like, yes, like U.S., like you can, or yes, Russia, you cannot invade any sovereign country anymore.
We're done with it.
Yeah. Yeah, so definitely there's some hypocrisy there. And Putin sees that. Like, he even gave, like, an open letter, I think, to the New York Times as, like, sort of a, like, tongue-in-cheek response to that level of hypocrisy that, you know, we don't always practice what we preach.
Yeah, and it's a fair thing to level against most nations in that way, right? Mm-hmm. There's a sounds like a joke, but it's like a discord called whataboutisms that is like this idea. So what about when you did that? But you shouldn't do this. But what about when you did that? And it's sort of this like, you know, blame shifting, which is important, I think, because states need to blame shift, otherwise they too much, you know, vision gets pointed on them, and states are usually looking out, as James Scott wants to make citizens legible, not itself the state being legible, right? That's a no-no. The panopticon would fall apart if we were looking back at it, you know. But yeah, it's funny to think about in terms of sort of where the, when you think about blame or like who's saying what, you know, what about the U.S. did this, you know, obviously you helped different South American dictators get in power, you know, and then totally screwed up people's lives and countries for a long time in order to sort of secure your own interests in these places. You know, these places, these kind of dialogues are kind of left off of the map, but again, right, then they get pointed out when then they're saying, well, you can't do this, Russia. We're saying, well, you did this. And it really is a tough thing to think about, I guess, because, you know, as everyday citizens have nothing to do with that, right? And most people don't, but again, we have these sort of state level groups of power. So, I mean, just these differential levels of power, like, they really put us in weird spots as we as citizens reading the news or talking about these issues, you know, because it's not a question of we need to go save the world, but you know, what's our role in these bigger issues like that? You know, how do we play into them?
Yeah, no, there's this almost this gray area that's created.
Yeah.
Going back, you know, thinking about, you know, where the state is with regards to our wife and children almost, you know, thinking about the excesses possibly in Putin's administration, but also think about the NSA scandal in the U.S.
Right.
And Julian Assange. And when he went on the run, you know, once he got to the embassy in London, the TV show that he broadcast his opinions on was a Russian TV show, right? Mm. So you have this back and forth between these countries, which it seems it opens up a very interesting space, I think.
Mm-hmm. Like the Cold War is essentially continuing as if nothing had ever happened in the intermediary.
Exactly. It's interesting to see how this antagonism is sort of playing into that role of the other, that these two major nation states are really weird inversions of one another that find this gray area of commonality and blame each other.
Right. Right. Well, the way that Russia is being discussed in official, like, media discourse in the United States is very much resonant with how it was discussed in the Cold War.
Very much.
And Putin is, like, so ridiculed, like, widely, which, I mean, granted, there's so much material there, like, to work with. I can see why, you know. Like, I remember on the Colbert, he's like, yeah, when I envisioned when Obama was on the phone with him that Putin was shirtless, like stroking a Siberian tiger and staring to an infinity mirror. Like, I totally thought that did resonate.
But even like the discourse of the Olympics in Sochi,
right?
Even the way that the U.S. commentators spoke about Russia. Like, I mean, I remember during the opening ceremony, one of the commentators said, "Well, they're still recovering from the fall of the Soviet Union." And I was like, "Come on! Like, that's what you're saying about them right now? Like, that's what you have this, you know?" And I mean, granted, there could be economic problems that are still happening because of that split. But like at the same time, it's like the discourse was very much about that only.
Yeah, and condescending in a way, almost.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, especially the whole conversation right about the security breaches and how you know, unsafe everyone's information was in Russia, right?
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning, it seemed we were always trying to find flaws in the Olympics,
right?
Almost, you know, to a level much, you know, higher than I think what the critiques were of the Beijing Olympics,
right?
Which is interesting.
Yeah, there's a couple articles I was reading about how there were expectations that Americans had that Russia would become westernized after the fall of the Cold War. So the critiques that people are levying against Russia during Sochi or prior to Sochi were kind of these expansions on, well, you're just not Western enough. You haven't met the Western standard.
Right.
And
yeah, there's an idea that sort of if you acquire Western-style capitalism, then issues like democracy and civil society will sort of naturally flow with that. And I think those ideas have clearly proven false. Like,
indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not working so well here, so...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, how do they spread? I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's been quite an event. I think the last couple of weeks have really shaken up a lot of, you know, world politics and whatnot, and we'll see. I mean, there are just so many possibilities, I think, that could come from this, especially looking at what's happening in eastern Ukraine, whether tensions will flare, whether there'll be anything that can kind of subside to any degree.
I mean, there's been so many. I mean, there was the Orange Revolution as well, so, like, you, this isn't new to Ukraine, but it's certainly taken a more dramatic turn this time around, so... The same thing has been happening in Kyrgyzstan with, like, a sort of north-south divide rather than an east-west divide. So who knows if the country could, in fact, split apart. That's been talked about on both sides.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have for this episode of This Anthropological Life. I think, thank you so much, Emily, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
It's a great conversation. But yeah, guys, so, you know, keep your eyes peeled on the news and always keep thinking. You know, how can you think about this in terms of anthropology, open up the possibilities, you know, look at the connections between these countries, between these peoples, and try to break down what lines there are or see the lines that aren't talked about.
Yeah, it's kind of what lines show up in terms of talking about ethnic groups or national groups or cultural groups or linguistic lines, right? What sort of things become visible in these sort of conflicts, right? And so what are people using? What is the media using? What are people on the street saying about the conflict, what's happening here, you know? It's a fascinating, kind of scary event, but it's you know, this is our world today, and it's worth turning the anthropological eye towards, I do suspect.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, I will be thinking about Putin stroking his tiger.
Such as it is. Well, thanks again, Emily, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having
me. So we had Emily Canning is a PhD student at Brandeis University, working on an excellent dissertation.
Inshallah.
Inshallah, right? The end is near. But this is Adam Gamble for This Anthropological Life.
This is Anil Tripathi.
And this is Ryan Collins.
We'll see you guys next time.
Have a good week.